Scholastic Audiobooks presents The 39 Clues, Book 1, The Maze of Bones, by Rick Riordan, read by David Pitou. Chapter 1. 5 minutes before she died, Grace Cahill changed her will. Her lawyer brought out the alternate version, which had been her most guarded secret for 7 years. Whether or not she would actually be crazy enough to use it, William McIntyre had never been certain.
"Madam," he asked, "are you sure?"
Grace gazed out the window, across the sunlit meadows of her estate. Her cat, Saladin, snuggled beside her as he had throughout her illness, but his presence was not enough to comfort her today. She was about to set in motion events that might cause the end of civilization.
"Yes, William."
Her every breath was painful.
"I'm sure."
William broke the seal on the brown leather folder. He was a tall, craggy man. His nose was pointed like a sundial, so it always cast a shadow over one side of his face. He had been Grace's advisor, her closest confidant, for half her life. They'd shared many secrets over the years, but none as perilous as this. He held the document for her to review. A fit of coughing racked her body. Saladin meowed with concern. Once the coughing passed, William helped her take the pen. She scrawled her weak signature across the paper.
"They're so young," William lamented. "If only their parents..." "But their parents didn't," Grace said bitterly. "And now the children must be old enough. They are our only chance." "If they don't succeed..." "Then 500 years of work have been for nothing," Grace said. "Everything collapses. The family, the world, all of it."
William nodded grimly. He took the folder from her hands. Grace sat back, stroking Saladin's silver fur. The scene outside the window made her sad. It was too gorgeous a day to die. She wanted to have one last picnic with the children. She wanted to be young and strong and travel the world again. But her eyesight was failing. Her lungs labored. She clutched her jade necklace, a good luck talisman she'd found in China years ago. It had seen her through many close calls with death, many lucky misses. But the talisman couldn't help her anymore. She'd worked hard to prepare for this day. Still, there was so much she'd left undone, so much she had never told the children.
"It will have to be enough," she whispered.
And with that, Grace Cahill closed her eyes for the last time. When he was sure Grace had passed away, William McIntyre went to the window and closed the curtains. William preferred darkness. It seemed more proper for the business at hand. The door opened behind him. Grace's cat hissed and disappeared under the bed. William didn't look back. He was staring at Grace Cahill's signature on her new will, which had just become the most important document in the Cahill family's history.
"Well?"
a brusque voice said. William turned. A man stood in the doorway, his face obscured by shadows, his suit as black as oil.
"It's time," William said. "Make sure they suspect nothing."
William couldn't tell for sure, but he thought the man in black smiled.
"Don't worry," the man promised. "They'll never have a clue."
Chapter 2. Dan Cahill thought he had the most annoying big sister on the planet, and that was before she set fire to $2 million. It all started when they went to their grandmother's funeral. Secretly, Dan was excited because he was hoping to make a rubbing of the tombstone after everyone else was gone. He figured Grace wouldn't care. She'd been a cool grandmother. Dan loved collecting things. He collected baseball cards, autographs of famous outlaws, Civil War weapons, rare coins, and every cast he'd ever had since kindergarten. All 12 of them. At the moment, what he liked collecting best were charcoal rubbings of tombstones. He had some awesome ones back at the apartment. His favorite read, "Pruella Good, 1891 to 1929. I'm dead. Let's have a party." He figured if he had a rubbing of Grace's tombstone in his collection, maybe it wouldn't feel quite so much like she was gone forever. Anyway, the whole way from Boston to the funeral in Worcester County, his great-aunt Beatrice was driving like a very slow lunatic. She went 25 miles an hour on the highway and kept drifting across lanes so the other cars honked and swerved and ran into guardrails and stuff. Aunt Beatrice just kept clutching the wheel with her jeweled fingers. Her wrinkly face was made up with day-glow red lipstick and rouge, which made her blue hair look even bluer. Dan wondered if she gave the other drivers nightmares about old clowns.
"Amy,"
she snapped, as another SUV careened down the exit ramp because Beatrice had just pulled in front of it.
"Stop reading in the car. It's not safe."
"But Aunt Beatrice..."
"Young lady, close that book."
Amy did, which was typical. She never put up a fight with adults. Amy had long reddish-brown hair, unlike Dan's, which was dark blonde. This helped Dan pretend his sister was an alien imposter, but unfortunately they had the same eyes. Green like jade, their grandmother used to say. Amy was 3 years older and 6 inches taller than Dan, and she never let him forget it, like being 14 was such a big deal. Usually she wore jeans and some old t-shirt because she didn't like people noticing her, but today she was wearing a black dress, so she looked like a vampire's bride. Dan hoped her outfit was as uncomfortable as his stupid suit and tie. Aunt Beatrice had thrown a fit when he tried to go to the funeral in his ninja clothes. It wasn't as if Grace would care if he was comfortable and deadly, the way he felt when he pretended to be a ninja. But of course Aunt Beatrice didn't understand. Sometimes it was hard for him to believe she and Grace were sisters.
"Remind me to fire your au pair as soon as we return to Boston," Beatrice grumbled. "You two have been entirely too spoiled."
"Nellie's nice," Dan protested.
"Huh, this Nellie almost let you burn down the neighbor's apartment building."
"Exactly."
Every couple of weeks, Beatrice fired their au pair and hired a new one. The only good thing was that Aunt Beatrice didn't live with them personally. She lived across town in a building that didn't allow kids, so sometimes it took her a few days to hear about Dan's latest exploits. Nellie had lasted longer than most. Dan liked her because she made amazing waffles, and she usually cranked her iPod up to brain damage level. She didn't even hear when Dan's bottle rocket collection went off and strafed the building across the alley. Dan would miss Nellie when she got fired. Aunt Beatrice kept driving and muttering about spoiled children. Amy secretly went back to her huge book. The last 2 days, since they got the news about Grace's death, Amy had been reading even more than usual. Dan knew it was her way of hiding, but he kind of resented it because it shut him out, too.
"What are you reading this time?"
he asked.
"Medieval European doorknobs? Bath towels through the ages?"
Amy gave him an ugly face, or an uglier-than-usual face.
"None of your business, dweeb. You can't call a ninja lord dweeb. You have disgraced the family. You must commit seppuku."
Amy rolled her eyes. After a few more miles, the city melted into farmland. It started to look like Grace country, and even though Dan had promised himself he wouldn't get sappy, he began to feel sad. Grace had been the coolest ever. She'd treated him and Amy like real people, not kids. That's why she'd insisted they simply call her Grace, not grandmother or gran or nana or any silly name like that. She'd been one of the only people who'd ever cared about them. Now she was dead, and they had to go to the funeral and see a bunch of relatives who had never been nice to them. The family cemetery sat at the bottom of the hill from the mansion. Dan thought it was kind of stupid they'd hired a hearse to carry Grace 100 yards down the driveway. They could have put wheels on the coffin, like they have on suitcases, and that would have worked just as well. Summer storm clouds rumbled overhead. The family mansion looked dark and gloomy on its hill, like a lord's castle. Dan loved the place, with its billion rooms and chimneys and stained glass windows. He loved the family graveyard even more. A dozen crumbling tombstones spread out across a green meadow ringed in trees, right next to a little creek. Some of the stones were so old the writing had faded away. Grace used to take Amy and him down to the meadow on their weekend visits. Grace and Amy would spend the afternoon on a picnic blanket, reading and talking, while Dan explored the graves and the woods and the creek. "Stop that," Dan told himself. "You're getting sentimental."
"So many people," Amy murmured as they walked down the driveway. "You're not going to freak out, are you?"
Amy fiddled with the collar of her dress.
I'm not freaking out, I just..."
"You hate crowds," he finished. "But you knew there'd be a crowd. They come every year."
Each winter, as long as Dan could remember, Grace had invited relatives from all over the world for a week-long holiday. The mansion filled up with Chinese Cahills and British Cahills and South African Cahills and Venezuelan Cahills. Most of them didn't even go by the name Cahill, but Grace assured him they were all related. She'd explain about cousins and second cousins and cousins three times removed until Dan's brain started to hurt. Amy would usually go hide in the library with the cat.
"I know," she said, "but, I mean, look at them all."
She had a point. About 400 people were gathering at the gravesite.
"They just want her fortune,"
Dan decided.
"Dan? Well, it's true."
They had just joined the procession when Dan suddenly got flipped upside down.
"Hey,"
he yelled.
"Look, guys,"
a girl said.
"We caught a rat."
Dan wasn't in a good position to see, but he could make out the Holt sisters, Madison and Reagan, standing on either side of him, holding him by his ankles. The twins had matching purple running suits, blonde pigtails, and crooked smiles. They were only 11, same as Dan, but they had no trouble holding him. Dan saw more purple running suits behind them. The rest of the Holt family. Their pit bull, Arnold, raced around their legs and barked.
"Let's fling him into the creek,"
Madison said.
"I want to fling him into the bushes," Reagan said. "We never do my ideas."
Their older brother, Hamilton, laughed like an idiot. Next to him, their dad, Eisenhower Holt, and their mom, Mary Todd, grinned like this was all good fun.
"Now, girls," Eisenhower said, "we can't go flinging people at a funeral. This is a happy occasion."
"Amy,"
Dan called,
"a little help here?"
Her face had gone pale. She mumbled,
drop,
Dan sighed in exasperation.
"She's trying to say drop me."
Madison and Reagan did. On his head.
"Ow,"
Dan said.
Madison,
Amy protested.
Yes,
Madison mimicked.
"I think all those books are turning your brain to mush, weirdo."
If it had been anybody else, Dan would have hit back, but he knew better with the Holts. Even Madison and Reagan, the youngest, could cream him. The whole Holt family was way too buff. They had meaty hands and thick necks and faces that looked like G.I. Joe figures. Even the mom looked like she should be shaving and chewing on a cigar.
"I hope you losers took a good last look around the house," Madison said. "You're not going to be invited back here anymore, now that the old witch is dead."
"Ruff,"
said Arnold the pit bull. Dan looked around for Beatrice, but as usual, she wasn't anywhere near them. She drifted off to talk to the other old people.
"Grace wasn't a witch," Dan said, "and we're going to inherit this place."
The big brother, Hamilton, laughed.
"Yeah, right."
His hair was combed toward the middle so it stuck up like a shark fin.
"Wait till they read the will, runt. I'm gonna kick you out myself."
"All right, team," the dad said. "Enough of this. Formation."
The family lined up and started jogging toward the gravesite, knocking other relatives out of their way as Arnold snapped at everyone's heels.
"Is your head okay?"
Amy asked guiltily. Dan nodded. He was a little annoyed Amy hadn't helped him, but there was no point complaining about it. She always got tongue-tied around other people.
"Man, I hate the Holts."
"We've got worse problems."
Amy pointed toward the gravesite, and Dan's heart sank.
"The Cobras," he muttered.
Ian and Natalie Cabra were standing by Grace's coffin. looking like perfect little angels as they talked to the preacher. They wore matching designer morning outfits that complemented their silky black hair and cinnamon-colored skin. They could have been child supermodels.
"They won't try anything during the funeral," Dan said hopefully. "They're just here for Grace's money like the rest of them, but they won't get it."
Amy frowned.
"Dan, did you really believe what you said about us inheriting the mansion?"
"Of course. You know Grace liked us best. We spent more time with her than anybody."
Amy sighed like Dan was too young to understand, which Dan hated.
"Come on," she said. "We might as well get this over with."
And together they waded into the crowd. The funeral was a blur to Dan. The minister said some stuff about ashes. They lowered the coffin into the ground. Everybody tossed in a shovel full of dirt. Dan thought the mourners enjoyed this part too much, especially Ian and Natalie. He recognized a few more relatives. Alistair Oh, the old Korean dude with the diamond-tipped walking stick who always insisted they call him uncle. The Russian lady, Irina Spassky, who had a twitch in one eye so everybody called her Spaz behind her back. The Starling triplets, Ned, Ted, and Sinead, who looked like part of a cloned Ivy League lacrosse team. Even that kid from television was there, Jonah Wizard. He stood to one side, getting his picture taken with a bunch of girls, and there was a line of people waiting to talk to him. He was dressed just like on TV, with lots of silver chains and bracelets, ripped jeans, and a black muscle shirt, which was kind of stupid since he didn't have any muscles. An older African-American guy in a business suit stood behind him, punching notes in a BlackBerry, probably Jonah's dad. Dan had heard that Jonah Wizard was related to the Cahills, but he'd never seen him in person before. He wondered if he should get an autograph for his collection. After the service, a guy in a charcoal gray suit stepped to the podium. He looked vaguely familiar to Dan. The man had a long, pointed nose and a balding head. He reminded Dan of a vulture.
"Thank you all for coming," he said gravely. "I am William McIntyre, Madam Cahill's lawyer and executor."
"Executor?"
Dan whispered to Amy.
"He killed her?" "No, you idiot,"
Amy whispered back.
"That means he's in charge of her will."
"If you will look inside your programs," William McIntyre continued, "some of you will find a gold invitation card."
Excited murmuring broke out as 400 people leafed through their programs. Then most of them cursed and shouted complaints when they found nothing. Dan ripped through his program. Inside was a card with a gold-leafed border. It read, "Dan and Amy Cahill are hereby invited to the reading of The Last Will and Testament of Grace Cahill. Where? The Great Hall, Cahill Manor. When? Now."
"I knew it,"
Dan said.
"I assure you," Mr. McIntyre said, raising his voice above the crowd, "the invitations were not done randomly. I apologize to those of you who are excluded. Grace Cahill meant you no disrespect. Of all the members of the Cahill clan, only a few were chosen as the most likely."
The crowd started yelling and arguing. Finally, Dan couldn't stand it anymore. He called out,
"Most likely to what?" "In your case, Dan,"
Ian Cabra muttered right behind him,
"to be a stupid American git."
His sister, Natalie, giggled. She was holding an invitation and looking very pleased with herself. Before Dan could kick Ian in a soft spot, the gray-suited man answered,
"To be the beneficiaries of Grace Cahill's will. Now, if you please, those with invitations will gather in the Great Hall."
People with invitations hurried toward the house like somebody had just yelled, "Free food!" Natalie Cabra winked at Dan.
"Ciao, cousin. Must run, collect our fortune."
Then she and her brother strolled up the drive.
"Forget them," Amy said. "Dan, maybe you're right. Maybe we'll inherit something."
But Dan frowned. If this invitation was such a great thing, why did the lawyer guy look so grim? And why had Grace included the Cabras? As he passed through the main entrance of the mansion, Dan glanced up at the stone crest above the door. A large C surrounded by four smaller designs. A dragon, a bear, a wolf, and two snakes entwined around a sword. The crest had always fascinated Dan, though he didn't know what it meant. All the animals seemed to glare at him like they were about to strike. He followed the crowd inside, wondering why those animals were so mad. The Great Hall was as big as a basketball court, with tons of armor and swords lining the walls and huge windows that looked like Batman could crash through them any minute. William McIntyre stood at a table in front with a projector screen behind him while everybody else filed into rows of seats. There were about 40 people in all, including the Holtz and the Cabras and Aunt Beatrice, who looked completely disgusted to be there. Or maybe she was just disgusted that everybody else had been invited to her sister's will reading. Mr. McIntyre raised his hand for quiet. He slipped a document from a brown leather folder, adjusted his bifocals, and began to read.
I, Grace Cahill, being of sound mind and body, do hereby divide my entire estate among those who accept the challenge and those who do not.
Whoa! Eisenhower Holt interrupted. What challenge? What's she mean?
I am getting to that, sir.
Mr. McIntyre cleared his throat and continued.
You have been chosen as the most likely to succeed in the greatest, most perilous undertaking of all time, a quest of vital importance to the Cahill family and the world at large.
40 people started talking at once, asking questions and demanding answers.
Perilous undertaking, Cousin Ingrid shouted. What is she talking about?
I thought this was about money,
Uncle Jose yelled.
A quest? Who does she think we are? We're Cahills, not adventurers.
Dan noticed Ian and Natalie Cabra exchange a meaningful look. Irina Spassky whispered something in Alastair O's ear, but most of the other spectators looked as confused as Dan felt.
Ladies and gentlemen, please, Mr. McIntyre said, if you will direct your attention to the screen. Perhaps Madam Cahill can explain things better than I.
Dan's heart did a flip-flop. What was Mr. McIntyre talking about? Then a projector on the ceiling hummed to life. The shouting in the room died down as Grace's image flickered on the screen. She was sitting up in bed with Saladin on her lap. She wore a black dressing gown, like she was a mourner at her own funeral, but she looked healthier than the last time Dan had seen her. Her complexion was pink. Her face and hands didn't look as thin. The video must have been made months ago, before her cancer got bad. Dan got a lump in his throat. He had a crazy urge to call to her, Grace, it's me, it's Dan. But of course it was just an image. He looked at Amy and saw a tear trickling down the base of her nose.
Fellow Cahills,
Grace said.
If you are watching this, it means I am dead, and I have decided to use my alternate will. No doubt you are arguing amongst yourselves and giving poor Mr. McIntyre a hard time about this contest I have instituted.
Grace gave the camera a dry smile.
You always were a stubborn bunch. For once, close your mouths and listen.
Hey, wait a minute,
Eisenhower Holt protested, but his wife shushed him.
I assure you,
Grace continued,
this contest is no trick. It is deadly serious business. Most of you know you belong to the Cahill family, but many of you may not realize just how important our family is. I tell you, the Cahills have had a greater impact on human civilization than any other family in history.
More confused shouting broke out. Irina Spassky stood up and yelled,
Silence! I wish to hear.
My relatives,
Grace's image said,
you stand on the brink of our greatest challenge. Each of you has the potential to succeed. Some of you may decide to form a team with other people in this room to pursue the challenge. Some of you may prefer to take up the challenge alone. Most of you, I'm afraid, will decline the challenge and run away with your tails between your legs. Only one team will succeed, and each of you must sacrifice your share of the inheritance to participate.
She held up a manila envelope sealed with red wax. Her eyes were as bright and hard as steel.
If you accept, you shall be given the first of 39 clues. These clues will lead you to a secret, which, should you find it, will make you the most powerful, influential human beings on the planet. You will realize the destiny of the Cahill family. I now beg you all to listen to Mr. McIntyre. Allow him to explain the rules. Think long and hard before you make your choice.
She stared straight into the camera, and Dan wanted her to say something special to them.
Dan and Amy, I miss you most of all. Nobody else in this room really matters to me.
Something like that. Instead, Grace said,
I'm counting on you all. Good luck, and goodbye.
The screen went dark. Amy gripped Dan's hand. Her fingers were trembling. To Dan, it felt like they'd just lost Grace all over again. Then everyone around them started talking at once.
Greatest family in history, Cousin Ingrid yelled. Is she crazy?
Stubborn, Eisenhower Holt shouted. She called us stubborn.
William,
Alistair O's voice rose above the rest.
Just a moment. There are people here I don't even recognize, people who may not even be members of the family. How do we know?
If you are in this room, sir, Mr. McIntyre said, you are a Cahill. Whether your surname is Cahill or not doesn't matter. Everyone here has Cahill blood.
Even you, Mr. McIntyre?
Natalie Cobra asked in her silky British accent. The old lawyer flushed.
That, miss, is beside the point. Now, if I might be allowed to finish.
But what's this about sacrificing our inheritance?
Aunt Beatrice complained.
Where's the money? It's just like my sister to come up with some foolishness.
Madam, Mr. McIntyre said, you may certainly decline the challenge. If you do, you will receive what is under your chair.
Immediately, 40 people felt around under their chairs. Eisenhower Holt was so anxious, he picked up Reagan's chair with her still in it. Dan discovered an envelope under his, stuck on with tape. When he opened it, he found a green slip of paper with a bunch of numbers and the words Royal Bank of Scotland. Amy had one too. So did everybody in the room.
What you now hold is a bank voucher, Mr. McIntyre explained. It shall only be activated if and when you renounce your claim to the challenge. If you so choose, each of you may walk out of this room with $1 million and never have to think of Grace Cahill or her last wishes again. Or you may choose a clue, a single clue that will be your only inheritance. No money, no property, just a clue that might lead you to the most important treasure in the world and make you powerful beyond belief.
William's gray eyes seemed to settle on Dan particularly.
Or it might kill you. $1 million or the clue. You have 5 minutes to decide.
Chapter 3. Amy Cahill thought she had the most annoying little brother on the planet, and that was before he almost got her killed. It all started when Mr. McIntyre read their grandmother's will and showed them the video. Amy sat there in shock. She found herself holding a green slip of paper worth $1 million. A challenge? A dangerous secret? What was going on? She stared at the blank projector screen. She couldn't believe her grandmother would do something like this. The video must have been made months ago, judging from the way Grace had looked. Seeing her on the screen like that had stung Amy worse than salt in a cut. How could Grace have been planning something this huge and not have warned them in advance? Amy never expected to inherit much. All she wanted was something to remember Grace by, a keepsake, maybe one piece of her beautiful jewelry. Now this, she felt completely lost.
It didn't help that Dan was jumping around like he needed to go to the restroom.
$1 million, he squealed.
I could get a Mickey Mantle rookie card and a Babe Ruth 1914.
His tie was crooked, which matched his crooked grin. He had a scar under one eye from when he'd gone commando raiding at 7 and fallen on his plastic AK-47. That's just the kind of little demon he was. But what Amy really resented was how comfortable he seemed, like all these people didn't bother him. Amy hated crowds. She felt like everyone was watching her, waiting for her to make a fool of herself. Sometimes in her nightmares, she dreamed she was at the bottom of a pit, and all the people she knew were staring down at her, laughing. She'd try to climb out of the pit, but she could never make it. Right now, all she wanted to do was run up to Grace's library, close the door, and curl up with a book. She wanted to find Saladin, Grace's Egyptian Mao, and cuddle with him. But Grace was dead, and the poor cat, who knew where he was now? She blinked tears out of her eyes, thinking about the last time she'd seen her grandmother.
"You will make me proud, Amy," Grace had said.
They'd been sitting on Grace's big four-poster bed with Saladin purring next to them. Grace had shown her a hand-drawn map of Africa and told her stories about the adventures she'd had when she was a young explorer. Grace had looked thin and frail, but the fire in her eyes was as fierce as ever. The sunlight turned her hair to pure silver.
"I had many adventures, my dear, but they will pale next to yours."
Amy wanted to cry. How could Grace think that Amy would have great adventures? She could barely muster enough courage to go to school every morning.
"I could get a ninja sword,"
Dan kept babbling.
"Or a Civil War saber."
"Dan, shut up," she said. "This is serious."
"But the money."
"I know," she said. "But if we took the money, we'd need to keep it for college and stuff. You know how Aunt Beatrice is."
Dan frowned like he'd forgotten. He knew good and well that Aunt Beatrice only looked after them for Grace's sake. Amy always wished Grace had adopted them after their parents died, but she hadn't. For reasons she never explained, she'd pressured Beatrice into being their guardian instead. For the last 7 years, Dan and Amy had been at Beatrice's mercy, living in a tiny little apartment with a series of au pairs. Beatrice paid for everything, but she didn't pay much. Amy and Dan got enough to eat and a new set of clothes every 6 months, but that was it. No birthday presents, no special treats, no allowance. They went to regular public school, and Amy never had extra money to buy books. She used the public library, or sometimes she'd hang out at the second-hand bookshop on Boylston, where the staff knew her. Dan made a little money on his own trading collectible cards, but it wasn't much. Every weekday, for 7 years, Amy had resented Grace for not raising them herself. But every weekend, Amy just couldn't stay mad at her. When they came to the mansion, Grace gave them undivided attention. She treated them like the most important people in the world. Whenever Amy got up the courage to ask why they couldn't stay with Grace all the time, Grace just smiled sadly.
"There are reasons, dear. Someday you will understand."
Now Grace was gone. Amy didn't know what Aunt Beatrice would do, but they could definitely use money. It would mean they'd have some independence. They could get a bigger apartment, maybe. They could buy books whenever they wanted and even go to college. Amy was desperate to go to Harvard. She wanted to study history and archaeology. Her mom would have liked that. At least, Amy hoped she would have. Amy knew so little about her parents. She didn't even know why she and Dan carried their mom's maiden name, Cahill, when their dad's last name had been Trent. She asked Grace about it once, but Grace had only smiled.
"It's how your parents wanted it," she said.
But the stubborn pride in her voice made Amy wonder if it had really been Grace's idea for them to carry the Cahill name. Amy had trouble remembering her mother's face or anything about her parents before the terrible night they died. And that was something Amy tried hard not to think about.
"Okay," Dan said slowly. "So I'll spend my million on my collection. You can spend yours on college. And everybody's happy."
Amy felt heartsick. Arguments were breaking out all over the room. The Holtz looked like they were conducting a combat exercise. Sinead Starling was holding her brothers, Ned and Ted, apart so they wouldn't strangle each other. Irina Spassky was talking in rapid-fire Russian to that kid from the reality TV show, Jonah Wizard, and his dad, but from the way they were staring back at her, it was obvious they didn't speak Russian. Angry voices filled the great hall. It was like they were tearing up Grace bit by bit, squabbling over her inheritance. They didn't care at all that Amy's grandmother had just passed away. Then somebody right behind her said,
"You'll decline the challenge, of course."
It was Ian Cabra, with his annoying sister Natalie at his side. Despite herself, Amy's stomach did a little somersault because Ian was very good-looking. He had gorgeous dark skin, amber eyes, and a perfect smile. He was 14, same as her, but he dressed like a grown-up, in a silk suit and tie. He even smelled good, like clove. Amy hated herself for noticing.
"I would be sad if something happened to you,"
Ian purred.
"And you so need the money."
Natalie put her hands to her mouth in mock surprise. She looked like a life-size doll in her satin dress, her luxurious black hair swept over one shoulder.
"That's right, Ian. They're poor. I keep forgetting. It seems so odd we're related, doesn't it?"
Amy felt herself blush. She wanted to say something scathing in reply, but her voice wouldn't work.
"Oh, yeah?"
Dan said.
"Well, maybe we're not related. Maybe you're mutant aliens because real kids don't dress like bankers and fly around in their daddy's private jet."
Ian smiled.
"You misunderstand me, dear cousin. We're very happy for you. We want you to take the money, have a wonderful life, and never think about us again."
Grace,
Amy managed, hating that her voice wouldn't cooperate.
Grace would want...
"Would want you to risk your lives?"
Ian supplied.
"How do you know? Did she tell you about this contest she was planning?"
Neither Amy nor Dan answered.
"I see,"
Ian said.
"That must be terrible, thinking you were Grace's favorites and then being left in the dark like that. Perhaps you weren't as important to the old woman as you thought, eh?"
"Now, Ian,"
Natalie chided.
"Perhaps Grace just knew they weren't up to the challenge. It sounds quite dangerous."
Natalie smiled at Amy.
"We'd hate to see you suffer a painful death, wouldn't we? Ta-ta!"
The Cabras drifted off through the crowd.
"Ta-ta,"
Dan mimicked.
What losers.
Part of Amy wanted to chase down the Cabras and hit them with a chair. But part of her wanted to crawl under a rock and hide. She'd wanted so badly to tell them off, but she hadn't even been able to speak.
"They're taking the challenge," she muttered.
"Well, duh,"
Dan said.
"What's another $2 million to them? They can afford to give it up."
"They were threatening us. They don't want us involved."
"Maybe they'll suffer a painful death,"
Dan mused.
"I wonder what the treasure is, anyway."
"Does it matter?"
Amy asked bitterly.
"We can't look for it. We barely have enough money for bus passes."
But still she found herself wondering. Grace had explored all over the world. Could the treasure be a lost Egyptian tomb or pirate's gold? Mr. McIntyre had said the prize would make the winners the most powerful human beings on Earth. What could do that? And why were there exactly 39 clues? She couldn't help being curious. She loved mysteries. When she was younger, she used to pretend her mother was still alive, and they would travel together to archaeological digs. Sometimes Grace would go too, just the three of them together, happily exploring the world. But that was just silly pretending.
"Too bad,"
Dan grumbled.
"I'd love to wipe the smiles off the Cobra's faces."
Just then, Aunt Beatrice grabbed their arms. Her face was contorted with rage, and her breath smelled like mothballs.
"You two will do nothing ridiculous. I fully intend to take my $1 million, and you will do the same. Never fear, I'll put it in an account for you until you're adults. I'll only spend the interest. In return, I will allow you to continue as my wards."
Amy choked with rage.
You'll allow us to be your wards? You'll allow us to give you our $2 million?
As soon as she said it, she couldn't believe she'd managed to get the words out. Beatrice usually scared her to death. Even Dan looked impressed.
"Watch your place, young lady," Beatrice warned. "Do the responsible thing or else."
"Or else what?"
Dan asked innocently. Beatrice's face turned bright red.
"Or else, you little upstart, I will disown you and leave you to social services. You will be penniless orphans, and I'll make sure no Cahill ever helps you again. This whole business is absurd. You'll take the money and wash your hands of my sister's ridiculous scheme for finding the...
She stopped abruptly.
Finding the what?
Dan asked.
Never you mind, Beatrice said.
With a shock, Amy realized Aunt Beatrice was scared.
Just make the right choice or you will never have my support again.
She marched off. Amy looked at Dan, but before she could say anything, Mr. McIntyre rang a little bell. Slowly, the wrangling and arguing in the great hall died down. The assembly took their seats.
It is time, Mr. McIntyre said. I must warn you that once the choice is made, there is no turning back. No changing minds.
Wait a moment, William,
Alastair O said.
This isn't fair. We know almost nothing about the challenge. How are we to judge whether it is worth the gamble?
Mr. McIntyre pursed his lips.
I am limited in what I can say, sir. You know that the Cahill family is very large, very old. It has many branches. Some of you, until today, did not even realize you were Cahills. But as Madame Grace said in her video address, this family has been instrumental in shaping human civilization. Some of the most important figures in history have in fact been Cahills.
Excited muttering filled the room. Amy's mind was racing. She'd always known the Cahills were important. A lot of them were rich. They lived all over the world. But shaping human civilization? She wasn't sure what Mr. McIntyre meant.
Historical figures? Mr. Holt bellowed. Like who?
Mr. McIntyre cleared his throat.
Sir, you would be hard-pressed to name a major historical figure in the last few centuries who was not a member of this family.
Abraham Lincoln,
Cousin Ingrid shouted out.
Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yes, Mr. McIntyre said simply. And yes.
A stunned silence fell in the room.
Harry Houdini,
Madison Holt shouted.
Lewis and Clark,
her sister Reagan suggested.
Yes, yes, and yes, Mr. McIntyre said.
Oh, come on,
Mr. Holt yelled. That's impossible.
I agree, Uncle Jose said. You're putting us on, McIntyre.
I am completely serious, the old lawyer assured him. And yet, all the previous accomplishments of the Cahill clan are nothing compared to the challenge that now faces you. It is the time for you to discover the greatest secret of the Cahills, to become the most powerful members of the family in history, or to die trying.
Amy felt something cold and heavy in her stomach, like she'd swallowed a cannonball. How could she be related to all those famous people? How could Grace possibly have thought Amy could become more powerful than them? She got nervous just thinking about it. There was no way she'd have the courage for a dangerous quest. But if she and Dan didn't accept the challenge, she remembered Beatrice clutching their arms, telling them to take the money. Beatrice would find a way to steal their $2 million. Amy wouldn't be able to stand up to her. They would go back to their dreary little apartment and nothing would change except Grace would be gone. No weekend trips to look forward to, nothing to remember her by. Amy never thought anything could be worse than when her parents died, but this was. She and Dan were totally alone. The only way out was this crazy idea that they were part of a great historical family, part of some mysterious contest. Amy's hands started to sweat.
Embarking on this quest, Mr. McIntyre was saying, will lead you to the treasure. But only one of you will attain it. One individual,
his eyes flickered across Amy's face,
or one team will find the treasure. I can tell you no more. I do not myself know where the chase will lead. I can only start you on the path, monitor your progress, and provide some small measure of guidance. Now, who will choose first?
Aunt Beatrice stood.
This is ridiculous. Any of you who play this silly game are fools. I'll take the money.
Mr. McIntyre nodded.
As you wish, madam. As soon as you leave this room, the numbers on your voucher will become active.
you may withdraw your money from the Royal Bank of Scotland at your leisure. Who's next?
Several more stood up and took the money. Uncle Jose, Cousin Ingrid, a dozen other people Amy didn't recognize. Each took the green voucher and became an instant millionaire. Then Ian and Natalie Cabra rose.
We accept the challenge,
Ian announced.
We will work as a team of two. Give us the clue.
Very well, Mr. McIntyre said. Your vouchers, please.
Ian and Natalie approached the table. Mr. McIntyre took out a silver cigarette lighter and burned the million-dollar papers. In return, he handed Ian and Natalie a manila envelope sealed with red wax.
Your first clue. You may not read it until instructed to do so. You, Ian and Natalie Cabra, will be team one.
Hey! Mr. Holt objected. Our whole family's taking the challenge. We want to be team one.
We're number one!
The Holt kids started chanting, and their pit bull, Arnold, leaped into the air and barked along with them. Mr. McIntyre raised his hand for silence.
Very well, Mr. Holt. Your family's vouchers, please. You shall be team... You shall also be a team.
They made the trade. $5 million vouchers for one envelope with a clue, and the Holts didn't even bat an eye. As they marched back to their seats, Reagan bumped Amy in the shoulder.
No pain, no gain, wimp.
Next, Alistair O struggled to his feet.
Oh, very well. I can't resist a good riddle. I suppose you may call me Team Three.
Then the Starling triplets rushed forward. They put their vouchers on the table, and $3 million more dollars went up in flames.
Duh,
Irina Spassky said.
I also shall play this game. I work alone.
Hey, yo, wait up!
Jonah Wizard sauntered forward like he was pretending to be a street punk, the way he did on Who Wants to Be a Gangsta, which was kind of ridiculous since he was worth about $1 billion and lived in Beverly Hills.
I'm all over this.
He slapped his voucher on the table. Hand me the clue, Holmes.
We'd like to film the contest,
his dad piped up.
No,
Mr. McIntyre said.
'Cause it would make great TV,
the dad said.
I could talk to the studios about a percentage split.
No,
Mr. McIntyre insisted.
This is not for entertainment, sir. This is a matter of life and death.
Mr. McIntyre looked around the room and focused on Amy.
Who else?
He called.
Now is the time to choose.
Amy realized she and Dan were the last ones undecided. Most of the 40 guests had taken the money. 6 teams had taken the challenge, all of them older or richer or seemingly more likely to succeed than Amy and Dan. Aunt Beatrice glared at them, warning them that they were about to get disowned. Ian was smiling smugly.
Perhaps you weren't as important to the old woman as you thought, eh?
Amy remembered what his annoying sister Natalie had said.
Grace just knew they weren't up to the challenge.
Amy's face felt hot with shame. Maybe the Cabras were right. When the Holts turned her brother upside down, she hadn't fought back. When the Cabras insulted her, she just stood there tongue-tied. How could she handle a dangerous quest? But then she heard another voice in her head.
You will make me proud, Amy.
And suddenly she knew. This was what Grace had been talking about. This was the adventure Amy was supposed to take. If she didn't, she might as well crawl under a rock and hide for the rest of her life. She looked at her brother. Despite how annoying he was, they had always been able to communicate just by looking at each other. It wasn't telepathy or anything, but she could tell what her brother was thinking.
It's a lot of money, Dan told her. A lot of awesome baseball cards.
Mom and Dad would want us to try,
Amy replied with her eyes.
This is what Grace wanted us to do.
Yeah, but a Babe Ruth and a Mickey Mantle.
Ian and Natalie will hate it,
Amy coaxed. And Aunt Beatrice will probably blow a gasket. A smile crept across his face.
I guess Babe Ruth can wait.
Amy took his voucher. They walked to the desk together, and she picked up Mr. McIntyre's lighter.
We're in,
she told him. And she sent $2 million up in smoke. Chapter 4. Dan felt a dizzy rush, like the time he ate 20 packs of Skittles. He couldn't believe how much money they'd just thrown away. Ever since he was little, he'd dreamed about doing something that would make his parents proud. He knew they were dead, of course. He barely remembered them. Still, he thought if he could just accomplish something amazing, even cooler than making the ultimate baseball card collection or becoming a ninja lord, his parents would somehow know. And they'd be proud. This competition to become the greatest Cahill sounded like the perfect chance. Plus, he liked treasure, and it was a real bonus that Aunt Beatrice's face turned completely purple as she stormed out of the room, slamming the door behind her. Now the great hall was empty, except for the 7 teams and Mr. McIntyre. After a tense silence, the old lawyer said,
"You may open your envelopes." Rip, rip, rip.
The clue was written in black calligraphy on cream paper. It read, "Resolution. The fine print to guess. Seek out Richard S."
"That's it?" Mary Todd Holt screeched. "That's all we get?"
10 words, Eisenhower Holt muttered. "That's..." He started counting on his fingers.
"Roughly $500,000 per word," Alistair O supplied. "Since your family gave up $5 million, I got a bargain. Each word only cost me $100,000.
"That's stupid," Madison Holt said. "We need more clue."
"Richard S.,"
Ian mused.
"Now who could that be?"
He looked at his sister, and they both smiled like they were sharing a private joke. Dan wanted to kick them.
"Wait a minute," Jonah Wizard's dad scowled. "Did everyone get the same clue? Because my son insists on exclusive material. It's in his standard contract."
"The 39 clues," Mr. McIntyre said, "are the major stepping stones to the final goal. They are the same for each team. The first one, which you have received, is the only one that will be so simple."
"Simple?" Alistair O raised his eyebrows. "I'd hate to see the difficult ones."
"However," Mr. McIntyre continued, "there are many paths to each clue. Hints and secrets have been buried for you to find. Clues to the clues, if you will."
"I'm getting a headache," Sinead Starling said.
"How you proceed is entirely up to you," Mr. McIntyre said. "But remember, you all seek the same end, and only one team will succeed. Speed is of the essence."
Irina Spassky folded her clue, stuck it in her purse, and walked out the door. Alistair O frowned.
"It seems Cousin Irina has an idea."
The Starling triplets put their heads together. Then, as if they'd gotten a collective brain flash, they stood up so fast they knocked over their chairs and ran outside. Jonah Wizard's dad pulled him into the corner. They had a heated discussion, and his dad typed some stuff into his BlackBerry.
"Got a jet," Jonah said. "Later, wanksters."
And off they went. That made 3 teams already out the door, and Dan still had no idea what the clue meant.
"Well..."
Ian Cabra stretched lazily, like he had all the time in the world.
"Are you ready, dear sister, to make fools of our American cousins?"
Natalie smiled.
"Any time."
Dan tried to trip them as they walked past, but they nimbly stepped over his leg and kept going.
"All right," Mr. Holt announced. "Team, form up."
The Holt clan shot to their feet. Their buff little pit bull, Arnold, barked and leaped around them like he was trying to bite their noses.
"Where we going, Dad?"
Hamilton asked.
"I don't know, but everybody else is leaving. Follow them."
They marched double time out of the Great Hall, which left only Amy, Dan, Alistair O, and William McIntyre.
"Dear me,"
Alistair sighed. With his black suit and silk cravat, he reminded Dan of a butler with a secret. His eyes seemed to be smiling, even when he wasn't.
"I think I'll have a stroll around the grounds and think about this."
Dan was thankful to see him leave. Alistair seemed like the nicest of their competition, but he was still competition. Dan stared at the clue again, more frustrated than ever.
"Resolution. Fine print. Richard S. I don't get it."
I can offer you no help with the clue. Mr. McIntyre managed a faint smile, but your grandmother would be pleased you accepted the challenge.
Amy shook her head.
We don't stand a chance, do we? The Cobras and the Starlings are rich. Jonah Wizard's famous. The Holts are like steroid monsters. Alistair and Arena seem so, I don't know, worldly. And Dan and I
have other talents, Mr. McIntyre finished, as I'm sure you'll find out.
Dan reread the clue. He thought about baseball cards and letters and autographs.
We're supposed to find this guy Richard, he decided. But why is his last name just S?
Amy's eyes widened.
Wait a minute. I remember reading that back in the 1700s, people used to do that. They would use only one letter if they wanted to disguise their names.
Huh, Dan said.
So, like, I could say A has a face like a baboon butt, and you wouldn't know who I'm talking about?
Amy boxed him on the ear.
Ow!
Children, Mr. McIntyre interrupted, you will have enough enemies without fighting each other. Besides, he checked his gold pocket watch, we don't have much time, and there is something I must tell you, something your grandmother wanted you to know.
An inside tip?
Dan asked hopefully.
A warning, young Master Dan. You see, all Cahills, if they know themselves to be Cahills, belong to one of four major branches.
Amy stood up straight.
I remember this. Grace told me once.
Dan frowned.
When did she tell you that?
In the library one afternoon. We were talking. She didn't tell me.
Maybe you weren't listening. There are four branches. The Ekaterina, the Janus, the, Thomas, and the Lucian.
Which are we?
Dan asked.
I don't know.
Amy looked at Mr. McIntyre for help.
She just mentioned the names. She wouldn't tell me what we are.
I'm afraid I can't help you there, Mr. McIntyre said,
but Dan could tell from his tone that he was keeping something back.
However, children, there is another, interested party you should know about. Not one of the four Cahill branches, but a group that may make your quest more difficult.
Ninjas?
Dan asked excitedly.
Nothing quite that safe, Mr. McIntyre said. I can tell you very little about them. I confess I know only the name and a few unsettling stories, but you must beware of them. This was your grandmother's last warning, which she made me promise to tell you if you accepted the challenge. Beware the Madrigals.
A chill went down Dan's back. He wasn't sure why. The name Madrigals just sounded evil.
But, Mr. McIntyre, who...
My boy, the old man said, I can tell you no more. I've stretched the rules of the competition, saying as much as I have. Just promise me you will trust no one. Please, for your own safety.
But we don't even know where to start,
Amy protested.
Everyone else just rushed off like they knew what to do. We need answers.
Mr. McIntyre stood. He closed his leather folder.
I must get back to my office. But, my dear, perhaps your way of finding out is not the same as the other teams. What do you normally do when you need answers?
I read a book.
Amy gasped.
The library! Grace's library!
She raced out of the great hall. Usually, Dan did not run with excitement when his sister suggested visiting a library. This time, he did. The library was next to Grace's bedroom, a big sunken parlor lined with bookshelves. Dan thought it was creepy being back here with just Amy, especially since Grace had died next door in her big four-poster bed. He expected the rooms to be all draped in black, with sheets over the furniture like you saw in movies, but the library was bright and airy and cheerful, just like it had always been. That didn't seem right to Dan. With Grace gone, the mansion should be dark and dreary, kind of the way he felt. He stared at the leather chair by the window and remembered one time he'd been sitting there, playing with a cool stone dagger he'd busted out of a locked display case. Grace had come up so quietly he didn't notice her until she was standing right over him. Instead of getting mad, she'd knelt next to him.
That dagger is from Tenochtitlan,
she'd said.
Aztec warriors used to carry these for ritual sacrifice. They would cut off the parts of their enemies that they believed held their fighting spirit.
She'd showed him how sharp the blade was, and then she left him alone. She hadn't told him to be careful. She hadn't gotten angry because he'd busted into her cabinet. She'd acted like his curiosity was totally normal, even admirable. No adult had ever understood Dan that well. Thinking about it now, Dan felt like somebody had cut away part of his spirit. Amy started searching the library books. Dan tried to help, but he had no idea what he was looking for and quickly became bored. He spun the old globe with brown seas and weird colored continents, wondering if it would make a good bowling ball. Then he noticed something he'd never seen before under the Pacific Ocean. A signature. Grace Cahill, 1964.
Why did Grace autograph the world?
He asked. Amy glanced over.
She was a cartographer, a map maker, and an explorer. She made that globe herself.
How did you know that?
Amy rolled her eyes.
Because I listened to her stories.
Huh.
That idea had never occurred to Dan.
So where'd she explore?
A man's voice said.
Everywhere.
Alastair O was leaning on his cane in the doorway, smiling at them.
Your grandmother explored every continent, Dan. By the time she was 25, she could speak 6 languages fluently, handle a spear or boomerang or rifle with equal skill, and navigate almost every major city in the world. She knew my hometown of Seoul better than I did. Then, for reasons unknown, she came back to Massachusetts to settle down. A woman of mystery. That was Grace.
Dan wanted to hear more about Grace's boomerang skills. That sounded sweet. But Amy stepped away from the bookcase. Her face was bright red.
Alastair, what do you want?
Oh, don't let me stop you. I won't interfere.
But there's nothing here, Amy mumbled. I was hoping for, I don't know, something I hadn't seen before, but I've read most of these. There really aren't that many books. And there's nothing about Richard S.
My dear children, may I suggest something? We need an alliance.
Dan was immediately suspicious.
Why would you want an alliance with a couple of kids?
The old man chuckled.
You have intelligence and youth and a fresh way of looking at things. I, on the other hand, have resources and age. I may not be one of the most famous Cahills, but I did change the world in my own small way. You know my fortune comes from inventions, eh? Did you know I invented the microwavable burrito?
Wow, Dan said.
Earth-shattering. There's no need to thank me. The point is, I have resources at my disposal, and you can't travel around the world on your own, you know. You'll need an adult chaperone.
Around the world? Dan hadn't thought about that. He hadn't even been allowed to go on the 4th grade field trip to New York last spring because he'd put Mentos in his Spanish teacher's Diet Coke. The idea that this clue hunt might take them anywhere in the world made him feel a little lightheaded.
But we can't help each other, Amy said. Each team is separate.
Alastair spread his hands.
We can't both win. But this challenge may take weeks, perhaps months. Until the end, surely we can collaborate? We are family, after all.
So give us some help, Dan decided. There's nothing here about Richard S. Where do we look?
Alastair tapped his cane on the floor.
Grace was a secretive woman, but she loved books. She loved them very much. And you're right, Amy. It does seem strange there are so few of them here.
You think she had more books?
Amy cupped her hand over her mouth.
A secret library?
Alastair shrugged.
It's a large house. We could split up and search.
But then Dan noticed something. One of those random little details that often caught his eye. On the wall, at the very top of the bookshelf, was a plaster crest, just like above the front door of the mansion. A fancy C, surrounded by 4 smaller coats of arms. A dragon, a bear, a wolf, and a pair of snakes wrapped around a sword. He must have seen this before a million times,
but he'd never noticed that the smaller crests each had a letter carved in the middle. E-T-J-L.
Get me a ladder, he said.
What? Alistair asked.
Never mind,
Dan decided. He began to climb the shelf, knocking down books and knickknacks.
Dan, get down, Amy protested. You're going to fall and break your arm again.
Dan had reached the crest, and he saw what to do. The letters were smudged darker than the rest of the stone, like they'd been touched many times.
Amy, he called down, what were those four branches again?
Ekaterina, she called. Thomas, Janus, Lucian.
Ekaterina, Dan repeated as he pressed the E. Thomas, Lucian, Janus.
As he pressed the last letter, the whole shelf swung outward. Dan had to jump away to avoid getting squished into a book sandwich. Where the bookshelf had been was a dark stairwell leading down.
A secret passage, said Uncle Alistair. Dan, I'm impressed.
It might be dangerous, Amy said.
You're right,
Dan agreed.
Ladies first.
Chapter 5. Amy could have lived in the secret library. Instead, she almost died there. She led the way down the steps and gasped when she saw all the books. They went on forever. She used to think the main public library on Copley Square was the best in the world, but this was even better. It seemed more library-ish. The shelves were dark wood, and the books were leather-bound and very old, with gilded titles on the spines. They looked like they'd been well-used over the centuries. Oriental carpet covered the floor. Cushy chairs were spaced around the room so you could plop down anywhere and start reading. Maps and oversized folios were spread out on big tables. Against one wall was a line of oak file cabinets and a huge computer with three separate monitors, like something they'd use at NASA. Glass chandeliers hung from the vaulted ceiling and provided plenty of light, even though the room was obviously underground. They descended a long way to get here, and there were no windows.
This place is amazing!
Amy ran into the room.
Books, Dan said. Yay!
He checked out the computer, but it was frozen on the password screen. He jiggled a few file cabinet drawers, but they were all locked. Uncle Alistair gingerly picked a red folio from the shelves.
Latin. Caesar's campaign in Gaul, copied on vellum. Looks like it was handwritten by a scribe around, 1500.
It must be worth a fortune, Amy said.
Dan suddenly looked more interested.
We could sell them, like on eBay?
Oh, shut up, Dan. These are priceless.
She ran her fingers along the spines. Machiavelli, Melville, Milton.
They're alphabetical by author. Find the S section.
They did, but it was a disappointment. There were 10 shelves packed with everything from Shakespeare's first folio to Bruce Springsteen's complete lyrics, but nothing with Richard for the first name.
Something about that,
Amy muttered. The name Richard S., coupled with the word resolution, kept nagging at her. They went together, but she didn't know how. It drove her crazy when she couldn't remember things. She read so many books sometimes, they got jumbled around in her head. Then she glanced down the aisle. At the end of the shelf, curled up on a box on a small table, was an old friend.
Saladin,
she cried. The cat opened his green eyes and said,
"Murr,"
without much surprise, like he was asking, "Oh, it's you? Did you bring me my red snapper?" Amy and Dan ran to him. Saladin had the most beautiful fur Amy had ever seen, silver with spots, like a miniature snow leopard. Well, not so miniature, actually, since he was pretty enormous, with huge paws and a long, striped tail.
Saladin, what are you doing down here?
Amy stroked his back. The cat closed his eyes and purred. Amy knew he was just a cat, but she was so happy to see him she could have cried. It was like part of Grace was still alive.
Hey, Saladin, Dan said. What's that you're sitting on, dude?
Meow.
Saladin complained as Dan lifted him up. Underneath was a polished mahogany box with the gold initials GC engraved on the lid. Amy's heart skipped a beat.
It's Grace's jewelry box.
Amy opened it up, and there was Grace's personal jewelry, which Amy had loved since she was little. Grace used to let her play with these, a pearl bracelet, a diamond ring, a pair of emerald earrings. Amy hadn't realized until much later that the stuff was real, worth thousands of dollars. She blinked the tears out of her eyes. Now that she'd found Saladin and the jewelry box, she felt like she really was standing in Grace's most secret place. She missed her grandmother so much it hurt. Then she pulled a very familiar piece of jewelry out of the box.
"Dear me," Alistair said. "That's her favorite necklace, isn't it?"
He was right. Amy had never seen her grandmother without this necklace. 12 intricately carved squares of jade with a green dragon medallion in the center. Grace had called it her good luck charm. Amy touched the dragon in the center. She wondered why Grace hadn't been buried with this necklace. It didn't seem right.
"Hey,"
Dan called.
"Look at this."
Amy found him around the corner, holding Saladin and staring at a giant wall map covered in push pins. The pins were in 5 different colors: red, blue, yellow, green, and white. Every major city in the world seemed to have at least one. Some areas were stuck with only red pins, some with green or blue, some with several colors.
"She's been doing voodoo on the world," Dan said.
"No, dummy," Amy said. "Those must be markers. They tell where something is."
"Like what?"
Amy shook her head. She found the map creepy.
"Maybe something about the Cahills?"
She glanced at Alistair. He frowned.
"I don't know, my dear. Most curious."
But he wouldn't meet her eyes, and Amy got the feeling he was hiding something.
"Look at Europe,"
Dan said.
"And the East Coast."
Those areas were heavily pinned in all 5 colors. Amy could hardly see the cities underneath. If these pins represented the Cahills, then it looked like they'd started somewhere in Europe and spread across the world, heavily colonizing North America. Then she thought,
Europe, colonies, North America.
The name Richard S. started nagging at her mind again, trying to scratch its way out. A name from the 18th century, someone who had written resolutions. Suddenly, she turned and raced down the row of shelves.
"Hey!"
Dan cried as Saladin wriggled out of his arms.
"Amy, where are you going?"
"The F's," she yelled.
"What for? Failure?"
She got to the F's and found it immediately. A tiny book, so tattered it was falling apart. The cover was decorated with a red and white woodblock print of colonial farmers. The title was faded, but she could still make out Poor Richard's Almanac for the Year 1739 by Richard Saunders.
"Of course," Uncle Alistair said. "Very good, my dear. Very good indeed."
Despite herself, Amy felt flush with pride.
"Wait a second," Dan said. "If this was written by Richard Saunders, what's it doing under F?" "Richard Saunders was a pseudonym," Uncle Alistair explained.
Dan knit his eyebrows.
"A fake foot?"
Amy wanted to strangle him, but Alistair said patiently,
"No, my dear boy, you're thinking of a pseudopod. A pseudonym is a fake name, a nom de plume, a disguise for the author. This book was written by a very famous person."
"Benjamin Franklin," Amy said. "I did a report on him last year."
She opened the book. The text was printed in block letters without much punctuation, so it was hard to read, but there were charts, illustrations, columns of numbers.
"This is the most famous thing Franklin ever published. Poor Richard was a character Franklin created. He had lots of pseudonyms like that. When he wrote, he would pretend he was different people."
"So we're related to a guy with multiple personalities," Dan said. "That's great.
Aren't almanacs for sports?"
"Not this kind," Amy said.
"This has facts for farmers. It's like a yearbook with useful tips and articles. Franklin put all his famous quotations in there, like, early to bed, early to rise.
Uh-huh.
And a rolling stone gathers no moss."
"Why would farmers care if stones are mossy or not?"
Amy was tempted to whack him with the book. Maybe that would loosen the stones in his head, but she kept her cool.
"Dan, the point is, he got very famous for this, and he made tons of money." okay?
Dan fished out the piece of paper with their first clue. He frowned at it.
So we found Richard S. How does that help us find our treasure? And what's resolution mean?
Franklin used to write resolutions for himself, Amy said. Rules he wanted to follow to improve himself.
Like New Year's resolutions?
Sort of, but he wrote them all year round, not just on New Year's.
So was that part of poor Richard's almanac?
Amy knit her eyebrows.
No, she said uneasily. His resolutions were from a different book. His autobiography, I think.
Maybe the word resolution in the clue was just to help us think of Benjamin Franklin. I'm not sure.
She turned a page in poor Richard's almanac. Notes were scribbled in the margins in several different handwriting styles. She caught her breath. She recognized one line of elegant script written in purple ink at the bottom of a page. She'd seen the same handwriting in old letters, treasures that Grace would show her from time to time. The notation simply read, "Follow Franklin, first clue, maze of bones."
"Mom wrote in here," she cried. "She always used purple pen."
"What?" Dan said. "Let me see."
"May I?"
Alistair asked. Amy wanted to hold the book forever. She wanted to devour every word her mother had written in it, but reluctantly, she handed it to Alistair.
"I want it right back," she insisted.
"No fair,"
Dan said. Alistair put on his glasses and examined a few pages.
"Interesting. Several generations have held this book. These notes here are in Grace's hand, and here, my father's handwriting, Gordon O. And here, James Cahill, Grace's father. They were brothers, you know, although Gordon's mother, my grandmother, was Korean."
"That's great," Dan said impatiently. "But why was our mom writing about Ben Franklin?"
Alistair arched his eyebrows.
"Obviously, Benjamin Franklin was a Cahill. That does not surprise me. He was an inventor, like me, after all. I would imagine most of the books in this library were written by members of our family, whether they knew their true bloodline or not."
Amy was stunned. All of these famous authors, Cahills? Was it possible, whenever she'd sat in a library, lost in books, she'd actually been reading the words of her relatives? She couldn't believe the Cahills could be so powerful, but Mr. McIntyre had told them their family had shaped human civilization. For the first time, she began to understand what that might mean. She felt like an enormous canyon was opening up at her feet. How had her mother known about the first clue, years before the contest began? Why had she chosen to write in this book? What did she mean by the maze of bones? There were too many questions.